As we know, Romeo Montague and Juliet Capulet were the ill-fated Shakespearean characters whose love was doomed by a feud between their families. Defying all parental attempts to keep them apart, the teenagers won a lasting union in their tragic act of twin suicide, an ultimate assertion of free will. The intensity of the couple's feelings and actions has always been a source of wonderment and puzzlement to observers of the play. How could such inordinate devotion develop so quickly in a pair so young? A romantic might suggest rare and perfect love. A social scientist, though, might point to the role of parental interference and the psychological reactance it can produce. Perhaps the passion of Romeo and Juliet was not initially so consuming that it transcended the extensive barriers erected by the families. Perhaps instead it was fueled to a white heat by the placement of those barriers. Could it be that had the youngsters been left to their own devices, their inflamed devotion would have amounted to no more than a flicker of puppy love? Because the story is fiction, such questions are, of course, hypothetical, and any answers to them are speculative. However, it is possible to ask and answer with more certainty similar questions about modern-day Romeos and Juliets. Do couples suffering parental interference react by committing themselves more firmly to the partnership and falling more deeply in love? According to a study done with 140 Colorado couples, that is exactly what they do. In fact, the researchers found that although parental interference was linked to some problems in the relationship, the partners viewed one another more critically and reported a greater number of negative behaviors than the other. That interference also made the pair feel greater love and desire for marriage. During the course of the study, as parental interference intensified, so did the love experience. And when the interference weakened, romantic feelings actually cooled. Although the Romeo and Juliet effect among modern teenagers may seem cute to outside observers, other manifestations of teenage reactance can prove tragic. For more than a decade, the major message of a massive advertising campaign for Virginia Slim cigarettes has been that today's women have come a long way from the old days when they were required by social norms to be subdued, proper, and ladylike. No longer, imply these ads, should a woman have to feel bound by chauvinistic and outmoded constraints on her independence and pointedly on her freedom to smoke cigarettes. Has the message been successful in triggering defiance of the old strictures among the target audience? One dismaying statistic suggests a lamentable answer. During the lengthy duration of this campaign, the percentage of cigarette smokers has risen in only one U.S. demographic group, teenage women. For twos and teens, then, psychological reactance flows across the broad surface of experience, always turbulent and forceful. For most of the rest of us, the pool of reactant energy lies quiet and covered, erupting geyser-like only on occasion. Still, these eruptions manifest themselves in a variety of fascinating ways that are of interest not only to the student of human behavior, but to lawmakers and policymakers as well. For instance, there's the odd case of Kennesaw, Georgia, the town that enacted a law requiring every adult resident to own a gun and ammunition, under penalty of 6 months in jail and a $200 fine. All the features of the Kennesaw gun law make it a prime target for psychological reactance. The freedom that the law restricts is an important long-standing one to which most American citizens feel entitled. Furthermore, the law was passed by the Kennesaw City Council with a minimum of public input. Reactance theory would predict that under these circumstances, few of the adults in the town of 5400 would obey. Yet newspaper reports testified that 3 to 4 weeks after passage of the law, firearm sales in Kennesaw were, no pun intended, booming. How are we to make sense of this apparent contradiction of the reactance principle? By looking a bit more closely at those who were buying Kennesaw's guns. Interviews with Kennesaw store owners revealed that the gun buyers were not town residents at all, but visitors, many of them lured by publicity to purchase their initial gun in Kennesaw. Donna Green, proprietor of a shop described in one newspaper article as a virtual grocery store of firearms, summed it up. "Business is great, but they're almost all being bought by people from out of town. We've only had two or three local people buy a gun to comply with the law." After passage of the law, then, gun buying had become a frequent activity in Kennesaw, but not among those it was intended to cover. They were massively non-compliant. Only those individuals whose freedom in the matter had not been restricted by the law had the inclination to live by it. A similar situation arose a decade earlier and several hundred miles to the south of Kennesaw, when Dade County, containing Miami, Florida, imposed an antiphosphate ordinance prohibiting the use and possession of laundry or cleaning products containing phosphates. A study done to determine the social impact of the law discovered two parallel reactions on the part of Miami residents. First, in what seems a Florida tradition, many Miamians turned to smuggling. Sometimes with neighbors and friends in large soap caravans, they drove to nearby counties to load up on phosphate detergents. Hoarding quickly developed, and in the rush of obsession that frequently characterizes hoarders, families were reported to boast of 20-year supplies of phosphate cleaners. The second reaction to the law was more subtle and more general than the deliberate defiance of the smugglers and hoarders. Spurred by the tendency to want what they could no longer have, the majority of Miami consumers came to see phosphate cleaners as better products than before. Compared to Tampa residents who were not affected by the Dade County ordinance, the citizens of Miami rated phosphate detergents as gentler, more effective in cold water, better whiteners and fresheners, more powerful on stains. After passage of the law, they had even come to believe that phosphate detergents poured more easily than did the Tampa consumers. This sort of response is typical of individuals who have lost an established freedom and is crucial to an understanding of how psychological reactants and scarcity work on us. When our freedom to have something is limited, the item becomes less available and we experience an increased desire for it. However, we rarely recognize that psychological reactance has caused us to want the item more. All we know is that we want it. Still, we need to make sense of our desire for the item, so we begin to assign it positive qualities to justify the desire. After all, it is natural to suppose that if one feels drawn to something, it is because of the merit of the thing. In the case of the Dade County antiphosphate law, and in other instances a newly restricted availability, that is a faulty supposition. Phosphate detergents clean, whiten, and pour no better after they are banned than before. We just assume they do because we find that we desire them more. The tendency to want what has been banned and therefore to presume that it is more worthwhile is not limited to such commodities as laundry soap. In fact, the tendency is not limited to commodities at all, but extends to restrictions on information. In an age when the ability to acquire, store, and manage information is becoming increasingly the determinant of wealth and power, it is important to understand how we typically react to attempts to censor or otherwise constrain our access to information. Although much data exists on our reactions to various kinds of potentially censorable material, media violence, pornography, radical political rhetoric, there is surprisingly little evidence as to our reactions to the act of censoring them. Fortunately, the results of the few studies that have been done on the topic are highly consistent. Almost invariably, our response to the banning of information is a greater desire to receive that information and a more favorable attitude toward it than before the ban. The intriguing thing about the effects of censoring information is not that audience members want to have the information more than they did before. That seems natural. Rather, it is that they come to believe in the information more, even though they haven't received it. For example, when University of North Carolina students learned that a speech opposing co-ed dorms on campus would be banned, they became more opposed to the idea of co-ed dorms. Thus, without ever hearing the speech, they became more sympathetic to its argument. This raises the worrisome possibility that especially clever individuals holding a weak or unpopular position can get us to agree with that position by arranging to have their message restricted. The irony is that for such people, members of fringe political groups, for example, the most effective strategy may not be to publicize their unpopular views, but to get those views officially censored, and then to publicize the censorship. Perhaps the authors of this country's constitution were acting as much as sophisticated social psychologists as staunch civil libertarians when they wrote the remarkably permissive free speech provision of the First Amendment. By refusing to restrain freedom of speech, they may have been attempting to minimize the chance that new political notions would win support via the irrational course of psychological reactants. Of course, political ideas are not the only kind that are susceptible to restriction. Access to sexually relevant material is frequently limited, although not as sensational as the occasional police crackdowns on adult bookstores and theaters. Regular pressure is applied by parents and by citizens' groups to censor the sexual content of educational material ranging from sex education and hygiene texts to books on the shelves of school libraries. Both sides in the struggle seem to be well-intentioned, and the issues are not simple since they involve such matters as morality, art, parental control over the schools, and First Amendment freedoms. But from a purely psychological point of view, those favoring strict censorship may wish to examine closely the results of a study done on Purdue University undergraduates. The students were shown some advertisements for a novel. For half the students, the advertising copy included the statement, "A book for adults only, restricted to those 21 years and over." The other half of the students read about no such age restriction on the book. When the researchers later asked the students to indicate their feelings toward the book, they discovered the same pair of reactions we have noted with other bands. Those who learned of the age restriction, one, wanted to read the book more, and two, believed that they would like the book more than did those who thought their access to the book was unlimited. It might be argued that although these results may be true for a small sample of sexually inclined college students, they would not apply to students in junior and senior high schools, where the sex curricula battles are actually being waged. Two factors make me doubt such an argument. First, developmental psychologists report that as a general style, the desire to oppose adult control begins quite soon in adolescence, around the start of the teenage years. Non-scientific observers have also noted the early rise of these strong oppositional tendencies. Shakespeare, scholars tell us, placed Romeo and Juliet at the ages of 15 and 13 years, respectively. Second, the pattern of reactions exhibited by the Purdue students is not unique, and thus can't be attributed to any great preoccupation with sex that college students may have. The pattern is common to externally imposed restrictions in general. Limiting access to the book had the same effects as did banning phosphate detergent in Florida, or censoring a speech in North Carolina. The people involved came to want the restricted item more and, as a result, came to feel more favorable toward it. Those who support the official banning of sexually relevant materials from school curricula have the avowed purpose of reducing the orientation of the society, especially its youth, towards eroticism. In the light of the Purdue study and in the context of other research on the effects of imposed restraints, one must wonder whether official censorship as a means may not be antithetical to the goal. If we are to believe the implications of the research, then the censorship is likely to increase the desire of students for sexual material and, consequently, to cause them to view themselves as the kind of individuals who like such material. The term official censorship usually makes us think of bans on political or sexual material. Yet there is another common sort of official censorship that we don't think of in the same way, probably because it occurs after the fact. Often in a jury trial, a piece of evidence or testimony will be introduced only to be ruled inadmissible by the presiding judge, who may then admonish the jurors to disregard that evidence. From this perspective, the judge may be viewed as a censor. Though the form of censorship is odd, the presentation of the information to the jury is not banned. It's too late for that. It's the jury's use of the information that is banned. How effective are such instructions from a judge? And is it possible that for jury members who feel it is their right to consider all the available information, declarations of inadmissibility may actually cause psychological reactants, leading the jurors to use the evidence to a greater extent? These are some of the questions asked in a large-scale jury research project conducted by the University of Chicago Law School. One reason the results of the Chicago jury project are informative is that the participants were individuals who were actually on jury duty at the time and who agreed to be members of experimental juries formed by the researchers. These experimental juries then heard tapes of evidence from previous trials and deliberated as if they were deciding the case. In the study most relevant to our interest in official censorship, 30 such juries heard the case of a woman who was injured by a car driven by a careless male defendant. The first finding of the study was no surprise. When the driver said he had liability insurance, the jurors awarded his victim an average of $4,000 more than when he said he had no insurance, $37,000 versus $33,000. Thus, as insurance companies have long suspected, juries make larger awards to victims if an insurance company will have to pay. The second finding of the study is the fascinating one, though. If the driver said he was insured and the judge ruled that evidence inadmissible, directing the jury to disregard it, the instruction to disregard had a boomerang effect, causing an average award of $46,000. So when certain juries learned that the driver was insured, they increased the damage payment by $4,000. But when other juries were told officially that they must not use that information, they used it still more, increasing the damage payment by $13,000. It appears, then, that even proper official censorship in a courtroom setting creates problems for the censor. We react to information restriction there, as usual, by valuing the banned information more than ever. The realization that we value limited information allows us to apply the scarcity principle to realms beyond material commodities. The principle works for messages, communications, and knowledge, too. Taking this perspective, we can see that information may not have to be censored for us to value it more. It need only be scarce. According to the scarcity principle, then, we will find a piece of information more persuasive if we think we can't get it elsewhere. This idea that exclusive information is more persuasive information is central to the thinking of two psychologists, Timothy Brock and Howard Fromkin, who have developed a commodity theory analysis of persuasion. The strongest support I know for Brock and Fromkin's theory comes from a small experiment done by a student of mine. At the time, the student was also a successful businessman, the owner of a beef importing company, who had returned to school to get advanced training in marketing. After we talked in my office one day about scarcity and exclusivity of information, he decided to do a study using his sales staff. The company's customers, buyers for supermarkets or other retail food outlets, were phoned, as usual, by a salesperson and asked for a purchase in one of three ways. One set of customers heard a standard sales presentation before being asked for their orders. Another set of customers heard the standard sales presentation plus information that the supply of imported beef was likely to be scarce in the upcoming months. A third group received the standard sales presentation and the information about scarce supply of beef, too. However, they also learned that the scarce supply news was not generally available information. It had come, they were told, from certain exclusive contacts that the company had. Thus, the customers who received this last sales presentation learned that not only was the availability of the product limited, so also was the news concerning it, the scarcity double whammy. The results of the experiment quickly became apparent when the company salespeople began to urge the owner to buy more beef because there wasn't enough in the inventory to keep up with all the orders they were receiving. Compared to the customers who got only the standard sales appeal, those who were also told about the future scarcity of beef bought more than twice as much. But the real boost in sales occurred among the customers who heard of the impending scarcity via exclusive information. They purchased six times the amount that the customers who received only the standard sales pitch did. Apparently, the fact that the news carrying the scarcity of information was itself scarce made it especially persuasive. Optimal conditions. Much like the other effective weapons of influence, the scarcity principle is more effective at some times than at other times. An important practical problem, then, is to find out when scarcity works best on us. A great deal can be learned in this regard from an experiment devised by social psychologist Stephen Werkle. The basic procedure used by Werkle and his research team was simple. Participants in a consumer preference study were given a chocolate chip cookie from a jar and asked to taste and rate its quality. For half of the raters, the jar contained 10 cookies. For the other half, it contained just 2. As we might expect from the scarcity principle, when the cookie was one of the only 2 available, it was rated more favorably than when it was one of 10. The The cookie in short supply was rated as more desirable to eat in the future, more attractive as a consumer item, and more costly than the identical cookie in abundant supply. Although this pattern of results provides a rather striking validation of the scarcity principle, it doesn't tell us anything we don't already know. Once again, we see that a less available item is more desired and valued. The real worth of a cookie study comes from two additional findings. Let's take them one at a time, as each deserves a thorough consideration. The first of these noteworthy results involved a small variation in the experiment's basic procedure. Rather than rating the cookies under conditions of constant scarcity, some participants were first given a jar of 10 cookies that was then replaced by a jar of 2 cookies. Thus, before taking a bite, certain of the participants saw their abundant supply of cookies reduced to a scarce supply. Other participants, however, knew only scarcity of supply from the outset, since the number of cookies in their jars was left at 2. With this procedure, the researchers were seeking to answer a question about types of scarcity. Do we value more those things that have recently become less available to us, or those things that have always been scarce? In the cookie experiment, the answer was plain. The drop from abundance to scarcity produced a decidedly more positive reaction to the cookies than did constant scarcity. The idea that newly experienced scarcity is the more powerful kind applies to situations well beyond the bounds of the cookie study. For example, social scientists have determined that such scarcity is a primary cause of political turmoil and violence. Perhaps the most prominent proponent of this argument is James C. Davies, who states that we are most likely to find revolutions where a period of improving economic and social conditions is followed by a short, sharp reversal in those conditions. Thus, it is not the traditionally most downtrodden people who have come to see their deprivation as part of the natural order of things, who are especially liable to revolt. Instead, revolutionaries are more likely to be those who have been given at least some taste of a better life. When the economic and social improvements they have experienced and come to expect suddenly become less available, they desire them more than ever and often rise up violently to secure them. Davies has gathered persuasive evidence for his novel thesis from a range of revolutions, revolts, and internal wars, including the French, Russian, and Egyptian revolutions, as well as such domestic uprisings as Dorr's Rebellion in 19th century Rhode Island, the American Civil War, and the urban black riots of the 1960s. In each case, a time of increasing well-being preceded a tight cluster of reversals that burst into violence. The racial conflict in America's cities during the mid-1960s represents a case in point that many of us can recall. At the time, it was not uncommon to hear the question, "Why now?" It didn't seem to make sense that within their 300-year history, most of which had been spent in servitude and much of the rest in privation, American blacks would choose the socially progressive 60s in which to revolt. Indeed, as Davies points out, the two decades after the start of World War II had brought dramatic political and economic gains to the black population. In 1940, blacks faced stringent legal restrictions in such areas as housing, transportation, and education. Moreover, even with the same amount of education, the average black family earned only a bit more than half of its counterpart white family. 15 years later, much had changed. Federal legislation had struck down as unacceptable formal and informal attempts to segregate blacks in schools, public places, housing and employment settings. Large economic advances had been made, too. Black family income had risen from 56% to 80% of that of a comparably educated white family. But then, according to Davies' analysis of social conditions, this rapid progress was stymied by events that soured the heady optimism of previous years. First, political and legal change proved substantially easier to enact than social change. Despite all the progressive legislation of the 40s and 50s, blacks perceived that most neighborhoods, jobs, and schools remained segregated. Thus, the Washington-based victories came to feel like defeats at home. For example, in the 4 years following the U.S. Supreme Court's 1954 decision to integrate all public schools, blacks were the targets of 530 acts of violence, direct intimidation of black children and parents, bombings and burnings, designed to prevent school integration. This violence generated the perception of another sort of setback in black progress. For the first time since well before World War II, when lynchings had occurred at an average rate of 78 per year, blacks had to be concerned about the basic safety of their families. The new violence was not limited to the education issue either. Peaceful civil rights demonstrations of the time were frequently confronted by hostile crowds and police. Still another type of downturn occurred, in pocketbook progress. In 1962, the income of a black family had slid back to 74% of that of a similarly educated white family. By Davies' argument, the most illuminating aspect of this 74% figure is not that it represented a long-term increase in prosperity from pre-1940s levels, but that it represented a short-term decline from the flush mid-1950s levels. In the next year came the Birmingham riots and, in staccato succession, scores of violent demonstrations, building toward the major upheavals of Watts, Newark, and Detroit. In keeping with a distinct historical pattern of revolution, blacks in the United States were more rebellious when their prolonged progress was curtailed somewhat than they were before it began. This pattern offers a valuable lesson for would-be rulers. When it comes to freedoms, it is more dangerous to have given for a while than never to have given at all. The problem for a government that seeks to improve the political and economic status of a traditionally oppressed group is that, in so doing, it establishes freedoms for the group where none existed before. And should these now established freedoms become less available, there will be an especially hot variety of hell to pay. We can look to much more recent events in the former Soviet Union for evidence that this basic rule still holds. After decades of repression, Mikhail Gorbachev began granting the Soviet populace new liberties, privileges, and choices via the twin policies of glasnost and perestroika. Alarmed by the direction their nation was taking, a small group of government, military, and KGB officials staged a coup, placing Gorbachev under house arrest and announcing on August 19, 1991, that they had assumed power and were moving to reinstate the old order. Most of the world imagined that the Soviet people, known for their characteristic acquiescence to subjugation, would passively yield as they had always done. Time magazine editor Lance Morrow described his own reaction similarly. At first, the coup seemed to confirm the norm. The news administered a dark shock, followed immediately by a depressed sense of resignation. Of course, the Russians must revert to their essential selves, to their own history. Gorbachev and glasnost were an aberration. Now we are back to fatal normality. But these were not to be normal times. For one thing, Gorbachev had not governed in the tradition of the Tsars, or Stalin, or any of the line of oppressive post-war rulers who had not allowed even a breath of freedom to the masses. He had ceded them certain rights and choices, and when these now established freedoms were threatened, the people lashed out the way a dog would if someone tried taking a fresh bone from its mouth. Within hours of the junta's announcement, thousands were in the streets, erecting barricades, confronting armed troops, surrounding tanks, and defying curfews. The uprising was so swift, so massive, so unitary in its opposition to any retreat from the gains of glasnost, that after only three riotous days, the astonished officials relented, surrendering their power and pleading for mercy from President Gorbachev. Had they been students of history or of psychology, the failed plotters would not have been so surprised by the tidal wave of popular resistance that swallowed their coup. From the vantage point of either discipline, they could have learned an invariant lesson. Freedoms once granted will not be relinquished without a fight. The lesson applies as well to the politics of family as country. The parent who grants privileges or enforces rules erratically invites rebelliousness by unwittingly establishing freedoms for the child. The parent who only sometimes prohibits between meal sweets may create for the child the freedom to have such snacks. At that point, enforcing the rule becomes a much more difficult and explosive matter because the child is no longer merely lacking a never-possessed right but is losing an established one. As we have seen in the case of political freedoms, and especially pertinent to the present discussion, chocolate chip cookies, people see a thing as more desirable when it has recently become less available than when it has been scarce all along. We should not be surprised, then, when research shows that parents who enforce discipline inconsistently produce generally rebellious children. Let's look back to the cookie study for another insight into the way we react to scarcity. We've already seen from the results of that study that scarce cookies were rated higher than abundant cookies, and that newly scarce cookies were rated higher still. Staying with the newly scarce cookies now, there was a certain cookie that was the highest rated of all, those that became less available because of a demand for them. Remember that in the experiment, the participants who experienced new scarcity had been given a jar of 10 cookies that was then replaced with a jar of only 2 cookies. Actually, the researchers did this in one of two ways. To certain participants, it was explained that some of their cookies had to be given away to other raters to supply the demand for cookies in the study. To another set of participants, it was explained that their number of cookies had to be reduced because the researcher had simply made a mistake and given them the wrong jar initially. The results showed that those whose cookies became scarce through the process of social demand liked them significantly more than those whose cookies became scarce by mistake. In fact, the cookies made less available through social demand were rated the most desirable of any in the study. This finding highlights the importance of competition and the pursuit of limited resources. Not only do we want the same item more when it is scarce, we want it most when we are in competition for it. Advertisers often try to exploit this tendency in us. In their ads, we learn that popular demand for an item is so great that we must hurry to buy, or we see a crowd pressing against the doors of a store before the start of a sale, or we watch a flock of hands quickly deplete a supermarket shelf of a product. There is more to such images than the idea of ordinary social proof. The message is not just that the product is good because other people think so, but also that we are in direct competition with those people for it. The feeling of being in competition for scarce resources has powerfully motivating properties. The ardor of an indifferent lover surges with the appearance of a rival. It is often for reasons of strategy, therefore, that romantic partners reveal, or invent, the attentions of a new admirer. Salespeople are taught to play the same game with indecisive customers. For example, a realtor who is trying to sell a house to a fence-sitting prospect will sometimes call the prospect with news of another potential buyer who has seen the house, liked it, and is scheduled to return the following day to talk about terms. When wholly fabricated, the new bidder is commonly described as an outsider with plenty of money, an out-of-state investor buying for tax purposes, and a physician and his wife moving into town are favorites. The tactic, called in some circles goosing them off the fence, can work devastatingly well. The thought of losing out to a rival frequently turns a buyer from hesitant to zealous. There is something almost physical about the desire to have a contested item. Shoppers at big closeout or bargain sales report being caught up emotionally in the event. Charged by the crush of competitors, they swarm and struggle to claim merchandise they would otherwise disdain. Such behavior brings to mind the feeding frenzy of wild, indiscriminate eating among animal groups. Commercial fishermen exploit this phenomenon by throwing a quantity of loose bait to large schools of certain fish. Soon the water is a roiling expanse of thrashing fins and snapping mouths competing for the food. At this point, the fishermen save time and money by dropping unbaited lines into the water, since the crazed fish will bite ferociously at anything now, including bare metal hooks. There is a noticeable parallel between the ways that commercial fishermen and department stores generate a competitive fury in those they wish to hook. To attract and arouse the catch, fishermen scatter some loose bait called chum. For similar reasons, department stores holding a bargain sale toss out a few especially good deals on prominently advertised items called loss leaders. If the bait of either form has done its job, a large and eager crowd forms to snap it up. Soon, in the rush to score, the group becomes agitated, nearly blinded by the adversarial nature of the situation. Humans, and fish alike, lose perspective on what they want and begin striking at whatever is being contested. One wonders whether the tuna flapping on a dry deck with only a bare hook in its mouth shares the what-hit-me bewilderment of the shopper arriving home with only a load of department store bilge. lest we believe that the competition for limited resources, fever, occurs only in such unsophisticated forms of life as tuna and bargain basement shoppers, we should examine the story behind a remarkable purchase decision made in 1973 by Barry Diller, who was then vice president for primetime programming at the American Broadcasting Company, but who has since been labeled the Miracle Mogul by Time magazine in reference to his remarkable successes as head of Paramount Pictures and the Fox Television Network. He agreed to pay $3.3 million for a single television showing of the movie The Poseidon Adventure. The figure is noteworthy in that it greatly exceeded the highest price ever previously paid for a one-time movie showing, $2 million for Patton. In fact, the payment was so excessive that ABC figured to lose $1 million on the Poseidon showing. As NBC Vice President for Special Programs Bill Stork declared at the time, there's no way they can get their money back, no way at all. How could an astute and experienced businessman like Diller go for a deal that would produce an expected loss of $1 million? The answer may lie in a second noteworthy aspect of the sale. It was the first time that a motion picture had been offered to the networks in an open bid auction. Never before had the three major commercial networks been forced to battle for a scarce resource in quite this way. The novel idea of a competitive auction was the brainchild of the movie's flamboyant showman producer, Irwin Allen, and a 20th Century Fox vice president, William Self, who must have been ecstatic about the outcome. But how can we be sure that it was the auction format that generated the spectacular sales price rather than the blockbuster quality of the movie itself? Some comments from the auction participants provide impressive evidence. First came a statement from the victor, Barry Diller, intended to set future policy for his network, in language sounding as if it could have escaped only from between clenched teeth, he said, ABC has decided regarding its policy for the future that it would never again enter into an auction situation. Even more instructive are the remarks of Diller's rival, Robert Wood, then president of CBS Television, who nearly lost his head and outbid his competitors at ABC and NBC. We were very rational at the start. We priced the movie out in terms of what it could bring in for us, then allowed a certain value on top of that for exploitation. But then the bidding started. ABC opened with $2 million. I came back with 2.4. ABC went to 2.8. And the fever of the thing caught us like a guy who had lost his mind. I kept bidding. Finally, I went to 3.2. And there came a moment when I said to myself, good grief, if I get it, what the heck am I going to do with it? When ABC finally topped me, my main feeling was relief. It's been very educational. According to interviewer Bob McKenzie, when Wood made his "it's been very educational" statement, he was smiling. We can be sure that when ABC's Diller made his never again announcement, he was not. Both men had clearly learned something from the Great Poseidon Auction. But for one, there had been a $1 million tuition charge. Fortunately, there is a valuable but drastically less expensive lesson here for us, too. It is instructive to note that the smiling man was the one who had lost the highly sought-after prize. As a general rule, whenever the dust settles and we find losers looking and speaking like winners and vice versa, we should be especially wary of the conditions that kicked up the dust. In the present case, open competition for a scarce resource. As the TV executives now know, extreme caution is advised whenever we encounter the devilish construction of scarcity plus rivalry. How to say no. It is easy enough to feel properly warned against scarcity pressures, but it is substantially more difficult to act on that warning. Part of the problem is that our typical reaction to scarcity hinders our ability to think. When we watch something we want become less available, a physical agitation sets in. Especially in those cases involving direct competition, the blood comes up, the focus narrows, and emotions rise. As this visceral current advances, the cognitive, rational side retreats. In the rush of arousal, it is difficult to be calm and studied in our approach. As CBS Television's president Robert Wood commented in the wake of his Poseidon Adventure, you get caught up in the mania of the thing, the acceleration of it. Logic goes right out the window. Here's our predicament, then. Knowing the causes and workings of scarcity pressures may not be sufficient to protect us from them because knowing is a cognitive thing, and cognitive processes are suppressed by our emotional reaction to scarcity. In fact, this may be the reason for the great effectiveness of scarcity tactics. When they are employed properly, our first line of defense against foolish behavior, a thoughtful analysis of the situation, becomes less likely. If because of brain-clouding arousal we can't rely on our knowledge about the scarcity principle to stimulate properly cautious behavior, what can we use? Perhaps in fine jiu-jitsu style we can use the arousal itself as our prime cue. In this way we can turn the enemy's strength to our advantage. Rather than relying on a considered cognitive analysis of the entire situation, we might simply tune ourselves to the internal visceral sweep for our warning. By learning to flag the experience of heightening arousal in a compliant situation, we can alert ourselves to the possibility of scarcity tactics there and to the need for caution. But suppose we accomplish this trick of using the rising tide of arousal as a signal to calm ourselves and to proceed with care. What then? Is there any other piece of information we can use to help make a proper decision in the face of scarcity? After all, merely recognizing that we ought to move carefully doesn't tell us the direction in which to move. It only provides the necessary context for a thoughtful decision. Fortunately, there is information available on which we can base thoughtful decisions about scarce items. It comes, once again, from the chocolate chip cookie study, where the researchers uncovered something that seems strange but rings true regarding scarcity. Even though the scarce cookies were rated as significantly more desirable, they were not rated as any better tasting than the abundant cookies. So despite the increased yearning that scarcity caused, the raters said they wanted to have more of the scarce cookies in the future and would pay a greater price for them. It did not make the cookies taste one whit better. Therein lies an important insight. The joy is not in experiencing a scarce commodity, but in possessing it. It is important that we not confuse the two. Whenever we confront the scarcity pressures surrounding some item, we must also confront the question of what it is we want from the item. If the answer is that we want the thing for the social, economic, or psychological benefits of possessing something rare, then fine. Scarcity pressures will give us a good indication of how much we would want to pay for it. The less available it is, the more valuable to us it will be. But very often, we don't want a thing purely for the sake of owning it. We want it instead for its utility value. We want to eat it, or drink it, or touch it, or hear it, or drive it, or otherwise use it. In such cases, it is vital to remember that scarce things do not taste, or feel, or sound, or ride, or work any better because of their limited availability. Although this is a simple point, it can often escape us when we experience the heightened desirability that scarce items naturally possess. I can cite a family example. My brother Richard supported himself through school by employing a compliance trick that cashed in handsomely on the tendency of most people to miss that simple point. In fact, his tactic was so effective that he had to work only a few hours each weekend for his money, leaving the rest of the time free for his studies. Richard sold cars, but not in a showroom nor on a car lot. He would buy a couple of used cars, sold privately through the newspaper on one weekend, and, adding nothing but soap and water, would sell them at a decided profit through the newspaper on the following weekend. To do this, he had to know three things. First, he had to know enough about cars to buy those that were offered for sale at the bottom of their Blue Book price range, but could be legitimately resold for a higher price. Second, once he got the car, he had to know how to write a newspaper ad that would stimulate substantial buyer interest. Third, once a buyer arrived, he had to know how to use the scarcity principle to generate more desire for the car than it perhaps deserved. Richard knew how to do all three. For our purposes, though, we need to examine his craft with just the third. For a car he had purchased on the prior weekend, he would place an ad in the Sunday paper. Because he knew how to construct a good ad, he usually received an array of calls from potential buyers on Sunday morning. Each prospect who was interested enough to want to see the car was given an appointment time. the same appointment time. So if six people were scheduled, they were all scheduled for, say, 2 o'clock that afternoon. This little device of simultaneous scheduling paved the way for later compliance because it created an atmosphere of competition for a limited resource. Typically, the first prospect to arrive would begin a studied examination of the car and would engage in standard car buying behavior, such as pointing out any blemishes or deficiencies, or asking if the price was negotiable. The psychology of the situation changed radically, however, when the second buyer drove up. The availability of the car to either prospect suddenly became limited by the presence of the other. Often the earlier arrival, inadvertently stoking the sense of rivalry, would assert his right to primary consideration. Just a minute now, I was here first. If he didn't assert that right, Richard would do it for him, addressing the second buyer. Richard would say, "Excuse me, but this other gentleman was here before you. So can I ask you to wait on the other side of the driveway for a few minutes until he's finished looking at the car? Then if he decides he doesn't want it, or if he can't make up his mind, I'll show it to you." Richard claims it was possible to watch the agitation grow on the first buyer's face. His leisurely assessment of the car's pros and cons had suddenly become a now or never, limited time only rush to decision over a contested resource. If he didn't decide for the car, at Richard's asking price, in the next few minutes he might lose it for good to that lurking newcomer over there. For his part, the second buyer would be equally agitated by the combination of rivalry and restricted availability. He would pace on the periphery, visibly straining to get at this now more desirable hunk of metal. Should 2 o'clock appointment number one fail to buy or even fail to decide quickly enough, 2 o'clock appointment number two was ready to pounce. If these conditions alone were not enough to secure a favorable purchase decision, immediately, the trap snapped surely shut as soon as the third 2 o'clock appointment arrived on the scene. According to Richard, stacked-up competition was usually too much for the first prospect to bear. He would end the pressure quickly by either agreeing to Richard's price or by leaving abruptly. In the latter instance, the second arrival would strike at the chance to buy out of a sense of relief, coupled with a new feeling of rivalry with that lurking newcomer over there. All those buyers who contributed to my brother's college education failed to recognize a fundamental fact about their purchases. The increased desire that spurred them to buy had little to do with the merits of the car. That failure of recognition occurred for two reasons. First, the situation Richard arranged for them produced an emotional reaction that made it difficult for them to think straight. Second, as a consequence, they never stopped to think that the reason they wanted the car in the first place was to use it, not merely to have it, and the competition for a scarce resource pressures Richard applied affected only their desire to have the car in the sense of possessing it. Those pressures did not affect the value of the car in terms of the real purpose for which they had wanted it. Should we find ourselves beset by scarcity pressures in a compliance situation, then, our best response would occur in a two-stage sequence. As soon as we feel the tide of emotional arousal that flows from scarcity influences, we should use that rise in arousal as a signal to stop short. Panicky, feverish reactions have no place in wise compliance decisions. We need to calm ourselves and regain a rational perspective. Once that is done, we can move to the second stage by asking ourselves why we want the item under consideration. If the answer is that we want it primarily for the purpose of owning it, then we should use its availability to help gauge how much we want to spend for it. However, if the answer is that we want it primarily for its function, that is, we want something good to drive, drink, eat, etc., then we must remember that the item under consideration will function equally well, whether scarce or plentiful. Quite simply, we need to recall that the scarce cookies didn't taste any better. Reader's report from a Blacksburg, Virginia woman. Last Christmas, I met a 27-year-old man. I was 19. Although he really wasn't my type, I went out with him, probably because it was a status thing to date an older man, but I really didn't become interested in him until my folks expressed their concern about his age. The more they got on my case about it, the more in love I became. It only lasted 5 months. But this was about 4 months longer than it would have lasted if my parents hadn't said anything. Although Romeo and Juliet have long since passed away, it appears that the Romeo and Juliet effect is alive and well, and making regular appearances in places like Blacksburg, Virginia. Epilogue. Instant influence. Primitive consent for an automatic age. Every day, in every way, I'm getting better. Emile Coué. Every day, in every way, I'm getting busier. Robert Cialdini. Back in the 1960s, a man named Joe Pyne hosted a rather remarkable TV talk show that was syndicated from California. The program was made distinctive by Pine's caustic and confrontational style with his guests. For the most part, a collection of exposure-hungry entertainers, would-be celebrities, and representatives of fringe political or social organizations. The host's abrasive approach was designed to provoke his guests into arguments, to fluster them into embarrassing admissions, and generally to make them look foolish. It was not uncommon for Pine to introduce a visitor and launch immediately into an attack on the individual's beliefs, talent, or appearance. Some people claimed that Pine's acid personal style was partially caused by a leg amputation that had embittered him to life. Others said no, that he was just vituperous by nature. One evening, rock musician Frank Zappa was a guest on the show. This was at a time in the 60s when very long hair on men was still unusual and controversial. As soon as Zappa had been introduced and seated, the following exchange occurred. Pine: I guess your long hair makes you a girl. Zappa: I guess your wooden leg makes you a table. Aside from containing what may be my favorite ad-lib, the above dialogue illustrates a fundamental theme of this book. Very often in making a decision about someone or something, we don't use all the relevant available information. We use, instead, only a single highly representative piece of the total. And an isolated piece of information, even though it normally counsels us correctly, can lead us to clearly stupid mistakes. Mistakes that, when exploited by clever others, leave us looking silly. Or worse. At the same time, a complicating companion theme has been present throughout this book. Despite the susceptibility to stupid decisions that accompanies a reliance on a single feature of the available data, the pace of modern life demands that we frequently use this shortcut. Recall that early in Chapter 1, our shortcut approach was likened to the automatic responding of lower animals, whose elaborate behavior patterns could be triggered by the presence of a lone stimulus feature. A cheep cheep sound, a shade of red breast feather, or a specific sequence of light flashes. The reason infrahumans must often rely on such solitary stimulus features is their restricted mental capability. Their small brains cannot begin to register and process all the relevant information in their environments. So these species have evolved special sensitivities to certain aspects of the information. Because those selected aspects of information are normally enough to cue a correct response, the system is usually very efficient. Whenever a female turkey hears cheep cheep, click whirr out rolls the proper maternal behavior in a mechanical fashion that conserves much of her limited brain power for dealing with the variety of other situations and choices she must face in her day. We, of course, have vastly more effective brain mechanisms than mother turkeys or any other animal group for that matter. We are unchallenged in the ability to take into account a multitude of relevant facts, and consequently to make good decisions. Indeed, it is this information processing advantage over other species that has helped make us the dominant form of life on the planet. Still, we have our capacity limitations too. And for the sake of efficiency, we must sometimes retreat from the time-consuming, sophisticated, fully informed brand of decision-making to a more automatic, primitive, single-feature type of responding. For instance, in deciding whether to say yes or no to a requester, it is clear that we frequently pay attention to but one piece of the relevant information in the situation. We have been exploring several of the most popular of the single pieces of information that we use to prompt our compliance decisions. They are the most popular prompts precisely because they are the most reliable ones, those that normally point us toward the correct choice. That is why we employ the factors of reciprocation, consistency, social proof, liking, authority, and scarcity so often and so automatically in making our compliance decisions. Each by itself provides a highly reliable cue as to when we will be better off saying yes than no. We are likely to use these lone cues when we don't have the inclination, time, energy, or cognitive resources to undertake a complete analysis of the situation. Where we are rushed, stressed, uncertain, indifferent, distracted, or fatigued, we tend to focus on less of the information available to us. When making decisions under these circumstances, we often revert to the rather primitive but necessary single piece of good evidence approach. All this leads to a jarring insight. With the sophisticated mental apparatus we have used to build world eminence as a species, we have created an environment so complex, fast-paced, and information-laden that we must increasingly deal with it in the fashion of the animals we long ago transcended. John Stuart Mill, the British economist, political thinker, and philosopher of science, died more than 100 years ago. The year of his death, 1873, is important because he is reputed to have been the last man to know everything there was to know in the world. Today, the notion that one of us could be aware of all known facts is only laughable. After eons of slow accumulation, human knowledge has snowballed into an era of momentum-fed, multiplicative, monstrous expansion. We now live in a world where most of the information is less than 15 years old. In certain fields of science alone, for example, physics, knowledge is said to double every 8 years. And the scientific information explosion is not limited to such arcane arenas as molecular chemistry or quantum physics, but extends to everyday areas of knowledge where we strive to keep ourselves current: health, child development, nutrition, and the like. What's more, this rapid growth is likely to continue, since 90% of all scientists who have ever lived are working today. Apart from the streaking advance of science, things are quickly changing much closer to home. In his book, Future Shock, Alvin Toffler provided early documentation of the unprecedented and increasing rapidity of modern daily life. We travel more and faster. We relocate more frequently to new residences, which are built and torn down more quickly. We contact more people and have shorter relationships with them. In the supermarket, car showroom, and shopping mall, we are faced with an array of choices among styles and products that were unheard of the previous year and may well be obsolete or forgotten by the next. Novelty, transience, diversity, and acceleration are acknowledged as prime descriptors of civilized existence. This avalanche of information and choices is made possible by burgeoning technological progress. Leading the way are developments in our ability to collect, store, retrieve, and communicate information. At first, the fruits of such advances were limited to large organizations, government agencies, or powerful corporations. For example, speaking as chairman of Citicorp, Walter Wriston could say of his company, "We have tied together a database in the world that is capable of telling almost anyone in the world almost anything immediately." But now, with further developments in telecommunication and computer technology, access to such staggering amounts of information is falling within the reach of individual citizens. Extensive cable and satellite television systems provide one route for that information into the average home. The other major route is the personal computer. In 1972, Norman McRae, an editor of The Economist, speculated prophetically about a time in the future. The prospect is, after all, that we are going to enter an age when any duffer sitting at a computer terminal in his laboratory or office or public library or home can delve through unimaginable increased mountains of information in mass assembly data banks with mechanical powers of concentration and calculation that will be greater by a factor of tens of thousands than was ever available to the human brain of even an Einstein. One short decade later, Time magazine signaled that McRae's future age had arrived by naming a machine, the personal computer, as its man of the year. Time's editors defended their choice by citing the consumer stampede to purchase small computers and by arguing that America, and in a larger perspective, the entire world, will never be the same. McRae's vision is now being realized. Millions of ordinary duffers are sitting at machines with the potential to present and analyze enough data to bury an Einstein. Because technology can evolve much faster than we can, our natural capacity to process information is likely to be increasingly inadequate to handle the surfeit of change, choice, and challenge that is characteristic of modern life. More and more frequently, we will find ourselves in the position of the lower animals, with a mental apparatus that is unequipped to deal thoroughly with the intricacy and richness of the outside environment. Unlike the animals, whose cognitive powers have always been relatively deficient, we have created our own deficiency by constructing a radically more complex world. But the consequence of our new deficiency is the same as that of the animal's long-standing one. When making a decision, we will less frequently enjoy the luxury of a fully considered analysis of the total situation, but will revert increasingly to a focus on a single, usually reliable feature of it. When those single features are truly reliable, there is nothing inherently wrong with the shortcut approach of narrowed attention and automatic response to a particular piece of information. The problem comes when something causes the normally trustworthy cues to counsel us poorly, to lead us to erroneous actions and wrong-headed decisions. As we have seen, one such cause is the trickery of certain compliance practitioners who seek to profit from the rather mindless and mechanical nature of shortcut response. If, as seems true, the frequency of shortcut response is increasing with the pace and form of modern life, we can be sure that the frequency of this trickery is destined to increase as well. What can we do about the expected intensified attack on our system of shortcuts? More than evasive action, I would urge forceful counterassault. There is an important qualification, however. Compliance professionals who play fairly by the rules of shortcut response are not to be considered the enemy. On the contrary, they are our allies in an efficient and adaptive process of exchange. The proper targets for counteraggression are only those individuals who falsify, counterfeit, or misrepresent the evidence that naturally cues our shortcut responses. Let's take an illustration from what is perhaps our most frequently used shortcut. According to the principle of social proof, we often decide to do what other people like us are doing. It makes all kinds of sense, since most of the time an action that is popular in a given situation is also functional and appropriate. Thus, an advertiser who, without using deceptive statistics, provides information that a brand of toothpaste is the largest selling or fastest growing, has offered us valuable evidence about the quality of the product and the probability that we will like it. Provided that we are on the market for a tube of good toothpaste, we might want to rely on that single piece of information, popularity, to decide to try it. This strategy will likely steer us right, will unlikely steer us far wrong, and will conserve our cognitive energies for dealing with the rest of our increasingly information-laden, decision-overloaded environment. The advertiser who allows us to use effectively this efficient strategy is hardly our antagonist, but rather must be considered a cooperating partner. The story becomes quite different, however, should a compliance practitioner try to stimulate a shortcut response by giving us a fraudulent signal for it. The enemy is the advertiser who seeks to create an image of popularity for a brand of toothpaste by, say, constructing a series of staged, unrehearsed interview commercials in which an array of actors posing as ordinary citizens praise the product. Here, where the evidence of popularity is counterfeit, we, the principle of social proof and our shortcut response to it, are all being exploited. In an earlier chapter, I recommended against the purchase of any product featured in a faked, unrehearsed interview ad, and I urged that we send the product manufacturers letters detailing the reason and suggesting that they dismiss their advertising agency. I would recommend extending this aggressive stance to any situation in which a compliance professional abuses the principle of social proof, or any other weapon of influence, in this manner. We should refuse to watch TV programs that use canned laughter. If we see a bartender beginning a shift by salting his tip jar with a bill or two of his own, he should get none from us. If after waiting in line outside a nightclub, we discover from the amount of available space that the wait was designed to impress passers-by with false evidence of the club's popularity, we should leave immediately and announce our reason to those still in line. In short, we should be willing to use boycott, threat, confrontation, censure, tirade, nearly anything to retaliate. I don't consider myself pugnacious by nature, but I actively advocate such belligerent actions because, in a way, I am at war with the exploiters. We all are. It is important to recognize, however, that their motive for profit is not the cause for hostilities. That motive, after all, is something we each share to an extent. The real treachery and the thing we cannot tolerate is any attempt to make their profit in a way that threatens the reliability of our shortcuts. The blitz of modern daily life demands that we have faithful shortcuts, sound rules of thumb to handle it all. These are not luxuries any longer. They are out-and-out necessities that figure to become increasingly vital as the pulse of daily life quickens. That is why we should want to retaliate whenever we see someone betraying one of our rules of thumb for profit. We want that rule to be as effective as possible. But to the degree that its fitness for duty is regularly undercut by the tricks of a profiteer, we naturally will use it less and will be less able to cope efficiently with the decisional burdens of our day. We cannot allow that without a fight. The stakes have gotten too high. This is George Newbern. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert B. Cialdini, Ph.D. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Suzanne Mitchell. Text copyright 1984, 1994, 2007 by Robert Cialdini. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.